Rise Up Chorus presents Meet the Musicians Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Lapine. Now, let's meet the musicians. Welcome to the 9th episode of Meet the Musicians Podcast. I'm your host, Matthew Lapine, and I'm thrilled to be leading you through a musician's story. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming a guest host to the podcast, my friend and colleague at Rise Up Chorus, Helen Kernizan. Helen is the director of Rise Up Chorus's Youth Chorus, and she teaches music at the Township of Ocean Intermediate School. This episode is the first in a series of conversations that Helen leads discussing the issues of race with professional, classical musicians and music educators of color. I am so proud of the work that Helen is doing in this area, and I couldn't be more excited to bring her interviews with you. Now, I pass the baton to Helen Kernizan in her interview with Wayne Millette on Meet the Musicians Podcast.
Here with us today is Wayne, and you pronounce it Millette, or is it Millet?
Correct, Millette, yeah.
Millette, okay, all right. Yeah. My husband is Haitian, so I'm so used to seeing something and making it French, you know.
Malay.
So
I didn't...
Okay, yeah. So Wayne Millette, who is currently supervisor of the fine arts for Scotch Plains Fanwood School District in New Jersey. And you and I met while you were working at Summit High School as the choral director, theory teacher, and musical director of your school's spring musicals. You and I first met, actually, I don't know if you even know this, but at an NJMEA conference where you were leading a session. It had some clever name like Don't Burn Out While Burning Bright. Do you remember?
Yes, I remember that. I remember that one, Teacher Burnout. I remember that.
Teacher Burnout, yeah. And so I have to say that I literally took all of your ideas about leadership roles for students and I just ran with them. And it really spoke to me as a teacher and a leader. And I thought that, you know, it was just awesome. So, and then I think it was a year later, we ran into each other at region auditions for region two. Mm-hmm. And you invited me, well, you invited everyone, but I felt personally invited to partake in your Summit High School Choral Festival, which we attended for 3 years. Yes. And the first time we went, it was so, and I think it was your, it might have been your second or third year doing it at that point. Mm-hmm. And it was so awesome to see how your students ran the whole thing. I mean, you know, I don't have to tell you, but they ran the entire show. It was so cool. You know, they took us to our holding room. They greeted us. They greeted us at the bus. It was phenomenal. And I guess you inspired me to get my Tri-M students to do the same thing for our spring musical. So I got them, they started being ushers and doing front of house, and that would, you inspired me to do that. And so I guess I wanted to ask you a little bit about the festival and how that came to be. Did you start with it like that, with the students being involved? And tell me a little bit about that.
Sure thing. So, well, thank you so much for having me. This is,
yes.
I love talking about music and music education and all of those great things. The Choral Festival, it is probably one of the things that I'm most proud of in my time as a music educator. And it really came out of this idea that I used to go up to a choral festival in North Jersey. And at that choral festival, there were people coming from all over, like the tri-state area. And it was a great opportunity, and the kids loved going. And, you know, we started to see how, you know, their kids were kind of doing a little bit of that. They were, you know, the kids were the liaisons, and, you know, they were in the audience, and it was a whole day-long thing. And, you know, but what happened was that, you know, as things get very busy, you know, it just always landed at this, like, worst time of the year.
Right.
And so I was talking with a couple of my friends that had always done it. And one of them taught at Morris Knowles, Mike Symantec, and another, Jamie Bunce, taught at Columbia High School. And we were just talking, and I said, you know, we need to get our kids together to see each other, you know, because the three of us would always sit there and, like, talk about shopping. Mm-hmm. And I always say, like, with Jamie Bunce, I could sit down at Starbucks with her, and I told somebody, we need to record us because this is a whole PD session right here. Like, we are a PD session. We are professional development. Just come watch us. But we just would always just shoot these ideas off. And then Mike and I, very similar, we would just always have these great conversations. And so we started talking about, you know, what would this look like? Could this thing happen? And we were just like, ah, who knows? And so all of a sudden, I just said, you know what? I really thought that we can do this. And so I reached out to them and I said, hey, I want to host it at my school. You know, is it something you think you would want to bring your kids to? And they were both like, absolutely. And then I was like, you know, let me see what I can do. So I started it. It just really started. It's one of those things, like I tell people, you know, nothing's going to happen unless you make it happen.
Right.
You got to start it. And, you know, you could have the ideas in here, but until you take that first step towards action, it just isn't going to happen. And so we began to, you know, I reached out to a couple of my old choir college professors and people that I had known over the years. So I reached out to them and they were to be adjudicators and they were like, absolutely, we'll come there for the day. And I talked to our music association and they were like, sure, you know, we'll, you know, just have them make the checks out to us, but we'll sponsor it. And then this will be something you could put back in the coffer. So this would be like a reoccurring account.
So this was like your... You mean you're like choir parents kind of thing? Is that what you meant?
Yes.
Okay, so they helped support that monetarily. Cool.
Correct. And yeah, so because we wanted to make sure that it was affordable for choirs to come in, and then we can pay the adjudicators that would come in. So we just started putting that together. And then I had always, much to your point, at that workshop session that I had done about teacher burnout, I really started to believe in the power of students and how much they could really run stuff. I would say like year two or three, started to do things like we started a choir council and we had officers running for that. And then we started to do section leaders. And it just began like once they started getting a taste of creating their own space and having ownership in not just, you know, it's great to have ownership in like the music, like letting the students choose a few pieces. But I mean, these kids felt so empowered because they were the ones taking attendance. And they were the ones when we would have concerts, they would help to line the students up before we go downstairs, you know, because there were so many things that they could do. And it was about me putting them in positions that they were manageable for them, but that things that they could really do. And so it just kind of started with like little responsibilities like that. And then when the choir festival came about, I met with them and I said, I want you all to take a lead role in this. And that's when we started doing it. And they just took it and ran with it. You know, they had, you know, the registration tables when you came in. They were so excited. They got these walkie-talkies. I mean, they just took it and ran with it.
Yes, the headsets.
The headsets.
My kids goodness. Were like, besides themselves.
they were like Secret Service. Because they loved it. And it was great because we also had a great collaboration with our theater department. And so the theater teacher and I, till this day, bestie friends,
right.
You know, she and I, you know, so we shared a lot of kids. And so there was a couple kids who were tech crew kids. Mm-hmm. And so they were used to organizing and calling the show for the musical. And so it was a natural inclination for them. So we actually drafted a couple of them to help with like, okay, we need you to backstage calling up which choir is coming in next, making sure it's running smoothly, making sure the MCs are on time. So we had we actually had the stage managers running that. And they had the walkie-talkies backstage and the ones up front with the registration. And they're like, okay, this choir has to come up next, please. And
on deck.
Yeah.
Walking with Perth Amboy.
They were so,
they were
my God.
On it.
They loved it. And it just always, for me, that just reminded me of how much students, of how powerful they are when you give them the license to do it. And that's really, couldn't love it more.
Yeah, and... You know, it's so people that aren't in education don't get it. And then people that are not in our field of the arts, they definitely don't get that element. Like, we don't teach music. We teach children, right? We teach students. Mm-hmm. We teach young adults. And these skills, just from this one event that you do once a year, you are teaching so many skills. You're teaching organizational skills. You're teaching planning skills. Mm-hmm. They realize how much behind the scene, they don't have to just show up and sing. And and then the pride that they have in that ensemble, you know, not just making music, but they have a home here. This is their mm-hmm. community. These are their, it's incredible. And I, you know, I really appreciated that. And, I see you. I saw what you were doing.
That's it. That is exactly that level of pride and care. Like, it just was so important to see them really just believe that, wow, this is like great. Like, you know, still getting emails from students from years back. I actually got a text message from one of my former students that I always say the choir, he was one of those kids that he needed the choir. Mm-hmm. And he grew so much as an individual, but he was always a good kid. He just needed a home and like a home with those kids. And he took a DNA test and was telling me that it actually detected that it was musical. And like, he was like so excited still. And when he graduated, it must've been about 7-8 years ago, but he's still like so excited that, wow, like they knew that I could do something. And I mean, but it's those little things that they see. It's so impressive. I love it.
So you're a Jersey boy, right? You grew up in Piscataway.
Born and raised. Yeah.
And you did your bachelor's in music ed at Mason Gross, mm-hmm. Of arts in Rutgers. And I'm assuming voice was your primary,
correct.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And then you got your master's of music and education from Northwestern.
Mm-hmm.
And then you did your ed leadership cert at Ramapo.
Correct.
And was Northwestern your first extended out of state experience?
Yeah.
What was that like?
It was a wonderful program, number one, where I loved it. But the way it was geared is that you could do it in the summers. And so you did it was kind of like this first step to like asynchronous at one point and then synchronous mm-hmm. in the summer. So you get this like summer intensive that you were out there from June. And then you came back like, okay, wow. Like now you're back to teaching.
So you were doing this while you were working.
While I was working. And I did 4 summers out in Chicago. And it was great because I had such a great time learning a different region and how they do music and music education. Mm. You know, because the Midwest, it's like they are – I would always say, like, the East is like, we are going to perform. The East will give you some performances like nobody did. Because I think we just have that access to New York City and all that access to this area. It just calls on you to perform. But really at Northwestern, that was the first place that I really delved into understanding strongly about curriculum, which happens in grad school anyhow. I think because undergrad, you really can't get enough. There's not enough credit hours and there's not enough years for you to get the curriculum.
We're already doing so much.
Right. But once you start to get into, to delve into that, but then there was people like Bennett Reamer was a professor at Northwestern. So, you know, I'm reading his book on the philosophy of music education, which I read in undergrad. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh my goodness, there he is like at the, you know, sitting on the bench right outside my music philosophy class. Right. So you're sitting there with all these individuals and then there are people that now I read about in articles like Carlos Abril and Maud Hickey. And like I said, Bennett Reamer was a big one. And there was all these names that you're like, oh, yeah, and Janet Barrett. But they just had this sensibility about them. And it was there that I really started to understand the performance is great, but the performance can't be the be all. You really need to use, you know, that performance to teach something. And so concerts that made a difference and themes. And it was there that I really felt that there was a they have a strong jazz contingency out there. And that was also where I really delved more into jazz music. And I got to really get a deeper understanding of that. And although New York has a great jazz scene, Chicago, they've got that. You know, they're the great migration started Louisiana, New Orleans. They came up through Chicago, you know. And so you got that St. Louis and that Chicago flavor. And so I really started to understand a bit more, I think, about the music of people that look like me. And I got to see a lot more of that in action out in Chicago than I did, per se, in New Jersey. But it was a bit of that culture shock because I would always have to come back to New Jersey. But that did help to keep me grounded. I really think that it helped to keep me grounded, coming back to my teaching position and then using the stuff that I learned while I was there. Mason Gross was like, yeah, we had our entity. We were tight there. Northwestern felt like it was more, it was still a smaller community because you still had the School of Music within there. Mm-hmm. But it definitely had a more, it was a bit more liberative. Like they felt a little bit more freedom to do things. Then also too, there was, and there's starting to be this even bigger push now that it's a lot more about student choice and student and right. trying to get out of this mold of, you know, 19th century European music. Like we've been sitting right. here doing this for the last longest. Northwestern seemed like it was trying to, even the music ed faculty was trying to push it there and, you know, for years. And they really started to make some, you know, some newer music ensembles. Rutgers was trying to, wasn't quite there because Rutgers was still very successful at its very traditional band, orchestra, wind ensemble, you know, the jazz band. Like, you know, they were very successful at their traditional styles of music. Northwestern was successful too, but Northwestern wasn't always known for that. Like Rutgers, if you look on the ACD list, is known for that. Northwestern is just, it's a group of, I think there that they push you to think. And they, you think there, like you come out of that place there, you gonna know how these two, how A plus B, they know what that's gonna equal out there. And not that Rutgers didn't support that, it's Northwestern is a research, strong research institution. And the right. music school, Northwestern had a conservatory, but Rutgers, I always say like that Mason Gross Conservatory was like, this is what we do right here.
Mm-hmm.
We have a conservatory. Northwestern being in School of Music was still part of the regular school. And so you were part of a research institution that you were coming out right. of it with that. So for grad school,
you were coming out with a Northwestern name, whereas when you come out of Mason Gross, you come out of Mason Gross, not necessarily Rutgers. It's total sidebar. When I auditioned at Rutgers, I had a letter of recommendation from my theater director. And the woman that auditioned me looked me in the face and she said, you know, this is a classical program, right? And I was like, yeah, I'm auditioning with classical pieces. Like, yes, but I can't know a theater teacher. I can't have a recommendation. Oh. And she like, it like almost like set her off. Like, and oddly enough, she ended up being my voice teacher at Westminster. So funny world, right?
Yes.
So yes. funny. So what a small world. But that's yeah, she ended crazy. Up being my wife. Wow. Isn't that funny? Well, that's a total sidebar.
But you know, it's so interesting because, you know, Mason Gross, like, they have a theater program, but it's, like, strictly drama. But never do they ever meet. They really don't have any kind of collaborations. And even within the music department, it was very separated. You know, that they expect us to do this classical repertoire still. And come out of here, and it's good to know I have a classical training and background and foundation, but that's not the only type of music that's sung in the world. Mm-hmm. You know, what about jazz? You know, what about jazz vocalists? What about teaching us how to do that? What about teaching us how to do gospel music? What about teaching us how to really do spirituals? Because I was the only one doing spirituals because I was Black at Mason Gross. Like, you know what? Why don't you make, you know, Pat over there, make Patrick sing a spiritual as well. You know, you're making me do German. You're making me do Italian. You're making me do the 24 Italian aria book. He ain't touched right. Harry Burley or nothing. And I'm like, no, make them do a spiritual. Like, teach us all how to do that.
And it's so, and I'm glad you brought that up because it segues really great into what I want to talk about with you next. I went to a conservatory.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Westminster where it was like, you know, we don't talk about anybody that's not a dead old white man, right? And yeah. I'll be honest with you, I didn't have a voice lesson until 6 months before I went to audition at Westminster.
Uh-huh.
And I grew up, I was a jazz head. I grew up, my dad loves jazz. I grew up listening to jazz and my choral director, when I told him I wanted to go to Westminster, he's in a Westminster alum. He said, why don't you want to go to Berkeley? You'll be a star there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I want to go to, and I would not trade my education for anything in the world.
Same but, here. Same here. Yep.
You know, I loved my Westminster experience, but I have to tell you, if it wasn't for Jubilee Singers, where I met Donald, you know,
mm-hmm.
I might have transferred because yeah. that's where it was a fusion, right? It was classical. met gospel and met jazz, and it was all Black American composers that I had never even experienced, you know. And I think, and you bring up a good point, why is Johnny not learning a spiritual, but I have to learn German? And the answer really is that it's not taught. These teach, I kid you not. A friend of mine was still at Westminster. She was undergrad and I had just graduated with my master's, and she called me during music history class in the middle of class. And she said, I just asked my professor, why are we not covering any Black composers? And the teacher, the professor of the class told me, we'll cover them during jazz. And she said to me, name me five Black classical composers. And I said, I'll name you 20. And
I, yes.
And really, I didn't know until Donald Dumpson exposed me to that.
Right.
But I had someone in my collegiate experience to expose me to that. And it was my connection. You know, I was the only white person in that choir. And I didn't care. And it was, you know, but that music and learning about that, that's what I'm teaching my students. You know, I'm, and I'll never forget when I was in grad school, I went straight through at Westminster. I did a 5-year program and I was in a conducting class with my master's. And I said, and we're learning how to freaking conduct recitatives. And I said, this is great. We're spending 3 weeks on recitatives. The class is only, you know, a few months. And we're on week 3 of recitatives and we're not done yet. I said, I'm going to be a high school choral director. I said,
when are you going to need to teach a recitative?
When are we going to cover?
Yeah.
Appropriate. And I said this, and he probably was like, shut up and sit down, you know. And his response was, you have to teach the kids quality music. And I said, what? These other composers, they're not quality?
They're not quality to them. Nope,
they're
not
quality. This, if it's not Puccini, it's not good. Right. What high school kid can sing Puccini? You know, those kids are few and far between.
Yeah, right. And that was because it was the music of the day. When it came out, that was the music of the day. And so I
that
wanted
to
pull it. That was their popular music. So right now, if we're going to say what is the music of the day, I mean, are you teaching them how to do Lady Gaga? Are you, you know, I'm like, do we teach them that? I don't know. Like, do we teach them how to sing like Aretha Franklin? Like, you look at it and it's like, there is a different culture that we're dealing with. And sometimes I do wonder, I'm like, who are we preparing these teachers to teach?
Right.
Who are we preparing to teach?
And as a black man in education, so it's a twofold question. The first part is, do you feel a responsibility to now, as you're a supervisor, right? To I don't want to say put pressure on, but put pressure on your teachers to give a fully equitable education, not only in terms of meeting the students where they are, but also in terms of exposing the students to things that they wouldn't normally be exposed to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. There is, I believe it is my obligation as a supervisor to make sure that we are teaching to the diverse learners of this community that we claim we have. And, you know, we have a student body that the music doesn't look like, the music doesn't sound like what they're used to hearing, you know? And so now I have to say, this district in general with Scotch Plains Fanwood, they're doing a really good job. They were doing a good job right before I got here. Like, I didn't come here and it was like all dead white guys. I mean, that's true. But the thing was that it was, and this is something I always believed, that it needs to be intentional in order to have real structural change. Because a lot of times if we just think it's going to happen on the wheels of inevitability, to quote Dr. King, then we're going to be in trouble because we're going to be waiting a long time. It is never going to be inevitable that change is going to happen. So I always believe that you have to be intentional with it. So I did. I really do feel that obligation to do that. And I also feel an obligation to look around for these young Black and brown, these students of color that need that, you know, they don't see someone that looks like them during the day. So I need to also make sure that not only can I be present as much as I can be, but also that in my hiring practices, that I'm considering that as a lens as well, that I need to consider where are the gaps, where there are gaps in here. And I can't just say, oh, well, they're not coming to apply here. Well, why aren't they? That's something we need to look at.
What are you doing to recruit?
To recruit. And that's so we need to start, when you go to these job fairs, where are we going? Are we going to the same colleges? Because if we're not going to at least two HBCUs a year, we're going to have a problem. You know, exactly. If we're not going to Temple to actually find some more, you know, people that have been trained in more urban education, William Patterson, I know they're doing some great work with trying to, you know, frame teachers within a more diverse setting. Like, we need to start going there as well to look at these students coming out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I noticed, and I guess this is a question really, as well as an observation. I noticed that your ensembles at Summit were very diverse. Do you feel that that was indicative of the population in Summit? Or do you think that was because as a Black male teacher, the kids felt comfortable and they came to the choir room?
That's a good question. I think it was a good mix of both, to be honest with you. I think that the population in Summit was becoming browner. We were definitely having a more influx of Latinx students. And there was always a strong Black contingency in Summit, which a lot of people didn't always know about. And so I really felt that when I came to the district, I think that it did, that it was good that I was Black, but it was also good that I understood how to connect to community. And that's something that whenever you're teaching, if you're going to teach a population that's going to be, especially Black, community is big to us. And community is bigger than just the classroom. It goes to their homes, connecting with their parents. And it means also connecting with their churches, connecting with the civic organizations are out there in the community. So Summit had several Black churches. I made it a point to actually get to know them there. They made it a point to get to know me, because they were like, you're teaching our children, so we need to know who you are too, sir. And so that was something that it was really important. And I'll be honest with you, at 23 years old, I didn't know this globally. I didn't think this globally, but I had an intuition that I'm like, oh, if I'm going to do, I need to connect to other people of color in this community. I need to understand that. So I think that there was, I had a very open expression. I was very open to teaching whomever. I was also very open to learning different cultures and learning about different music styles. You know, understanding that even when I was starting to teach music, I think it was a song. It was from Cuba. I can't remember the name of the song. And I remember too, that the first time I taught it, I had mispronounced something. And when the students called me out on it, and I was like, oh, wait, you didn't do your homework, you know? Mm-hmm. And part of me wanted to get very defensive, but then the other part of me went to her the next day and I said, can you help me with this? Can you help me pass this? I said, can you be the one to pronounce it? But before we do it, can you and I sit down and help me do this? And so then I really learned, like, when I'm teaching a song that isn't indicative of me, I got to do a lot of homework to be respectful of it. And even if I can't do it 100% correctly, that'll reach out to people that can. So one of my best friend from high school is Filipino. And so I was like, hey, I want to do this song. It was from the Philippines. I'm like, I need help with the language. So he called his dad. His dad spoke the translation. They lived in California. So he actually recorded it for me, and then I brought it to the kids. And so it required me to dig outside of myself. And I think all that research showed that I had a respect for the communities. And so I think that that really bred to, yeah, there was a lot more Black students in the choir than other ensembles that were in the school. But there was also a stronger Latinx community in there. And then there was a lot more Asians that were starting to join as well. So that I was starting to get a wider diversity of students. And I think it was because the community was wider and more diverse, but it really was the level of respect that I was giving to it helped to do that. And then students will feel safe when they understand, oh, there's others like me in this choir. There's others like me in this choir. I can be in it. And I think that it does something psychologically, but it just, I think it does it on a deeper level, not so very surface.
Yeah, I think, yeah, absolutely. And kids talk, we know that. Kids talk, they'll say, oh, you know, Mr. Mallette, you know, he did this, blah, blah, blah. They'll talk and then they'll say, oh, that's cool. I think that's what I'm about. I think I want to try that. And like we were talking about before, about creating community, giving kids the ownership, then the kids are starting to recruit. Like I used to have, you know, I'd have a kid, every week he brought a new kid to choir.
Right.
Oh, come and sing.
Right.
And so that is so important too. And like you said, if you're doing music, now, do we have to do Lady Gaga in every choir for every concert? No, there's a time and place, right? Mm-hmm. That maybe that's show choir. Maybe show choir does pop.
Right.
Right. You know, maybe you and that's what's so cool about music is that there's so many facets that you can be as creative or as uncreative as you want to be. Right.
Right.
It's really wonderful. And, how do you feel, how about as an educator in, or even as a supervisor, do you feel that you have different standards either for yourself or do you feel that you're perceived differently as a Black educator? Anywhere you want to go with that, I'll let you run.
That child, I need to come on, running shoes on for that one. That's a marathon. It is. So when you start to look at some of the readings of Derrick Bell and understand about critical race theory, you know, he talks about how race is permanent and we're not going to get rid of it. And the perception of that is going to be permanent. And you can look at it through a lens of depression, because the more you start looking at it, you're like, well, this is never going to go anywhere. This is an elephant that's not going to move. But if you also look at it through a lens of hope and a lens of inspiration, and you look at it through a lens of understanding that we're not always, victory isn't the goal. Winning this thing is not the goal. It's about the struggle. And can you still survive and thrive in the struggle? That's what it's also about. Because life is not going to be about winning a prize every single day. You know, winning is a very American thing. You're gonna win so much you're gonna be tired of winning. We remember heard that one a couple of years ago. Child, we lost so much in them. Child, don't get me started. But you know, like that whole thing is it's an American thing. It's not exceptionalism. And so keeping that in mind, understanding that there's gonna be that permanence of race does help you to understand that I can walk into a space. And there's a lot of times because of my position, I am Black, but I take on the power of a white person. So my positionality does impact certain things. And I understand that. And I never forget, I used to see it when I would perform with the kids from Summit. We would go to different locations. And a lot of times the wait staff would look at me. And they would see me in this tuxedo and running the show with all these kids, like just running them around. And you're just like, and they would see that, but there was a position of authority that I had. And so it becomes this inherent power, because race is always about power. So there's these different lenses that you start to look at it through. And so you start to see these things. And so even though I understand that a lot of times the positions that I'm in now as an administrator within a district, it affords me a comfort level of, oh, he's got some authority. Sometimes they don't always see the badge. And if they don't see the badge, there's been times I've been stopped in the hallway. Now, we should be being very secure about who's there, but it's how you stop me.
Right.
You know, and it's because you might see the white dad coming in and you're going to maybe ask him, excuse me, do you have an ID there? Excuse me, who are you? And you're like, you know, and so even though they don't see the badge, and all of a sudden I flash the badge and it says supervisor, and they're like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't know who you are. And it's like, but you should still talk to me as a human being, whether or not you know who I am. Like, that has nothing to do with it, you know? And there has been times that race has come up in conversations with my superintendents, my assistant superintendents. And I've had to make very clear that something that I felt was done would not have happened to a white person. And not even about me, but when I see it done to another teacher or something. There are certain times that I've seen some things happen to kids and I've had to call them out on it. And there's some white teachers that get they get very offended by that. And I'm like, well,
they're fragile.
They get very fragile. And I'm like, oh no, honey, I don't have time for your fragility right now. We're going to need you to put your pants on. Let's go. We've got to be tough. But in general, there is a lens of race that I will always, that I'm aware that I will always be judged with. And, you know, you can tell people try to handle you a little differently. You know, I could even tell when I got to this community that the parents was trying to figure out how are we going to handle this? How are we going to handle him? What kind of music are they going to start doing now? You know, what's going to happen with all of that? Like, there's all these little things that they're trying to figure out because it's still a mystery to them. So you start to see some of those things through the lens of race. And I feel comfortable that I have a very comfortable level with people. I can communicate to them very well. But there's admittedly times when it gets exhausting. And it's a level of tiredness that waves over you. And it was a huge last year with George Floyd. And I never forget, we were in an administrator's meeting with all the principals and the superintendent and everything like that. And, you know, I made my mind up. It was right after George Floyd. I said, I ain't going to say it because I know they're going to bring it up. I'm like, I can't talk about it. And it was in the middle of the pandemic, too. And I was like, I can't talk about this. I can't talk about it.
Yeah, we were like 2 months in, right? At that point.
And and it was heavy. And I just remember saying, I was like, I said I wasn't going to say anything. And I said it. And I was like, I said I wasn't going to say something, but I just have to say, it's just exhausting that we talk about it, but we only talk about race in this context. We only talk about Black people in this context. And we have to wait till now to have this conversation. And I told him, I said, I'm sorry, y'all need to have this conversation without me. Because it's only me and one other Black administrator out of the many administrators we have in this district. I'm like, y'all need to have the conversation without us because it's not our problem to fix. And you get tired, but then I realized, and I saw this quote, when you get tired of something, don't quit, just take a nap. You know, like, you can get tired, take your rest. Within the next day, you know, because I know there is a young Black boy in this district that needs a good education. And I understand that I'm not going to be his savior, but I can help to create a classroom that's going to be better for him. I can help to hire a teacher that he can relate to. I can help to create that curriculum that he can see himself or she can see herself, creating windows so they can see the world, but a mirror for them to see themselves. Like, I have to take that in mind, that I can get tired and maybe I don't engage with you in every conversation about race, but look what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to make sure that our hiring practices are equitable. And even if I don't hire a Black person, I hire somebody that's going to see you as an individual and know you and respect you. They don't have to be Black in order to do that, but they have to have that lens. So even in interview questions, I always ask a little secret question, you know, about, you know, so how are you going to deal with this child? And they get out of control because they're not doing, you know, the Jay-Z song that they want you to do. You know, I'm going to see what lens are you going to take it through? You know, how are you going to deal with this? Because it's real. Like, as you know, there's only in the teaching profession, out of the 4 million teachers in America, 7% are Black. 2% are Black men. And that's down from 4% back in 2008. So not only are there fewer Black men, it's a dwindling number of Black male educators. And so because of that, you become hyper visible because there's so few of you. You become hyper visible, and that hyper, it's like being on social media 24/7. It's exhausting, mm-hmm. and you tend to be like not sure of, you know, what you tend to watch yourself because you're not sure how it's going to be viewed. And as much as you hear them say, "Oh, we're not going to judge you differently because you're black," you're just like, "But I'm not going to give you the excuse to." So there is a weight that comes along with it and a responsibility. And with all of that, you know, it is very humbling. And I actually heard this weekend in a conversation I was having with a workshop I was doing. And the woman said, you know, at first, when you're the first, it's wonderful because, you know, oh, you feel special. You know, it's like history. We talk about the first black president, the first black scientist. Oh, it's wonderful. But then after the fourth time of being the first, you're like, well, is this going to keep going? Like, you start to get exhausted with being the first. You know, you're like, well, where's the community? Because you're looking for community. Where is somebody that I can just go in and just have a conversation and put my guard down and be relaxed? You know, you want to have that when instead of, you know, especially as a supervisor, you're in the district sometimes, you know, get there 8 a.m, you got to stay up to the concerts over at 10 p.m. You want to be able to feel comfortable, you know, and put your hair down and just be like, oh, I can go into this restaurant and not worry about, okay, is anybody else that looks like me in this place? But you got to be part of that community, and that's the thing. So it is a level of exhaustion, but it is not without hope, because in my heart, I have to believe that we can make differences. And in my heart, I have to believe that, you know, when I see the younger generation, there is something a little different in them than even there was, I think, in our generation. There's a level of, there's an ability to see racism and call it out and stay on it that I haven't seen before. And from whites and blacks and, you know, you know, there's something about this younger crew that really sees it. And I'm not naive enough to think that there are those in that age that don't see it and that don't purposely want to see it. But I believe that there's a lot of them that do see it and they're not tolerating that as it is. So that's where my hope is, that I'm like, oh, we can change some minds. It can be done.
Yeah. That's what it's all about. Having that hope. I mean, otherwise, like you said, you don't want to have a sense of hopelessness where you then it's what's the point, right? And we don't ever want to feel that way. And I wonder if and of course you're younger. You were younger as a teacher and less experience, life experience, all of it. Do you feel more pressure now or more resistance, so to speak, if you do, as a supervisor or as a teacher, or was it a little bit of both? What do you think?
As far as
and of course the communities, right? of course the communities are very different, right? The demographic is different, not super different.
Correct. Yeah. I feel that as I become a supervisor, you're getting hit from so many different directions. And I think you also see the lens a lot more of, you know, like, because that, you know, now I'm in this level of always looking at curriculum, looking at intentions and really trying to decipher things in the classroom. Yeah, we got a concert next month. We got to sing. Like, I don't care. You know, you call me every name you want to under the sun. You're going to sing this B flat and doing a tune. You know, like your mindset is a little bit, you're trying to get it going. Whereas as a supervisor, you know, I have to always have this bigger view. I'm always looking district-wide, K-12, I'm trying to understand things, you know, on different levels. And so I think I see it a lot more as a supervisor. And I think, you know, from as far as resistance from the community, I'll just be real. Scotch Plains, there's a strong contingency of resistance to diversity training. I didn't see that much in Summit. Now, once again, I'm at a different lens, because the resistance I've seen is I can see when there's an issue happening at the elementary school. I see that when I was teaching in high school, I didn't know if there was something that happened.
You were in a bubble, right?
Yeah, I'm in that bubble, so I didn't see it there. So I can't claim that there was nothing happening in Summit. But I've just seen that Scotch Plains, there is a resistance. I've seen more racial bias incidences in Scotch Plains than I have in Summit. Once again, I'm more exposed now. I see a lot more of things and I'm privy to some things. There's a strong contingency of people that fight hard in Scotch Plains, that they do want to see change and they push. But there's a bigger pushback to it. And a lot of it harkens to, there's a lot of people say things like, you know, well, you know, if we do all this training and things and, you know, there's going to be, you know, we're teaching that there's differences in America and we should be trying to teach that we're all one. And it's like they do this whole guise of trying to do multiculturalism, that they call it, where they, you know, we're all one people. We're all one nation under God. And we need to make sure that we're telling people that. I'm like, yeah, but no, because I had a different experience than you. And if I drive out into the street, I'm going to have a different experience than you. If I get pulled over by the police in this town, I will have a different experience than you. So you can say there's one America, but for me, it's about three or four different Americas. And then also too, I'm not going to fear immigration coming down my door. You know, there's other these multiple facets, but if you never have to experience that, it just doesn't sit well, you know, with some people when you want to talk about race and when you really, and then also too, when you want to help people be, you know, you should be proud to be Black. Well, we have one America. We don't have a Black national anthem. Lift every voice and sing is not the national flag. Well, you know what? For me, it is. You know, for me, it carries a weight that the Star Spangled Banner may not necessarily carry. Will I stand for the Star Spangled Banner? Absolutely. Will I sing it? Yes. Have I conducted it? Absolutely. I will never say that it's not that. But my experience, you know, let our rejoicing rise high as the listening sky. That resonates with my struggle, you know, stormy the road we trod. You know, that's the America that I've had to come up through. Even growing up in New Jersey, living in the suburbs, you know, it's been rough. There has been some rough moments, and you know, so understanding that there is resistance, and I think that there will always be resistance, but resistance builds muscle, and that's what we have to remember. That ultimately, that's how when they talk about grit, you know, Angela Duckworth, she's talking about grit. You know, now there's some folk that got an issue with that because I'm like, Black folk are the greediest folk you ever want to know because we don't learn how to live, you know, through a lot and still living through a lot, you know. But all that aside, there is a level of resilience that we do come out of it with. And I would love to live in a world where I wouldn't need all that resilience. It would be nice if I didn't have to have that. But the reality is that we don't have that. And so, understanding that, I'm grateful for the resistance because it has built my resilience and it's helped me to persevere. It has helped me, you know, when people are like, why you do so much? You doing this and you doing that thing. I'm like, I ain't got time to be tired. You know, in my head, I'm like, I have a mission. I want to help more kids of color, more Latinx, more Black, more Hispanic, more South Asian. I want to see them get involved in music education because I know the power, the transformative power of music education. And I want to see as many get involved in it as possible. And so if I got to kick open some more doors and let some more people in, okay, if I have to be one of the first, I can do that because my parents did that for me. My grandparents did that for me. They kicked the door open. So now that's my goal. My door is to open that door for more Black and Brown administrators to come in through these different school districts and be a part of it, for more choir teachers of color to come into different schools and come into schools that are predominantly white and be able to teach there as well. Like, I want you to teach wherever you want to teach. I want you to teach, whether you want to be in the area where there's going to be more Black and Brown people, or if you want to be there where there's going to be more predominantly white people. You should have the freedom to do so and the ability to be comfortable in either space. And so maybe it takes me coming into that space and doing it and then inviting my friends in that space because they invited me in their spaces, you know. And so people see more, they know more. Comfortability really helps to bring down stereotypes because then you're like, oh, all Black people are not the same. You know, you start to realize that they're all not the same, you know. And yeah. So there's resistance is real and you'll always run into it. But I, you know, it's par for the course.
Yeah. And like you said, exposure is the biggest thing. I feel,
yeah.
And my husband and I talk about this all the time, like the LGBTQ movement, I feel, has progressed faster in many ways than the Black civil rights movement. Not in every aspect, but in terms of community acceptance, because majority of people in the country have at least one gay person or queer person in their family. Mm-hmm. Not every white family has a Black person in their family. So if they never have to speak to, or deal with a Black person on an intimate level, they won't. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they know that their cousin Johnny, who's gay, is a good person, even though he's gay. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? I don't know if that makes sense.
No, I hear you. Yeah, and I think even, that, yeah. And I was just going to say, I think there's, you know, there's definitely been progress in the LGBTQ community, and it feels like it's accelerated. You know, that was where, because if you look back 20 years ago, Pew Research, people, it was like maybe 25-30% of America felt that gays should have the right to get married. You fast forward to 2010, that tide was shifting very fast. And there was more of an acceptance because, once again, you had television shows like Will and Grace, Ellen. You had these acceptable queer folk, acceptable gay people on television, and it made it comfortable. It made it the Cosby Show. Now, we can say whatever we want to say about Bill Cosby. I'm not going to debate whatever happened there. But the Cosby Show itself, and this I keep telling people, you wouldn't have a Barack and Michelle Obama if it wasn't for Bill and Claire Huxtable. That television show made white America feel like Black people were okay.
And
they weren't like, and I love Good Times, but they weren't struggling in the hood. They weren't struggling through, you know, gang violence. They weren't working all the time and never getting anywhere. They, you know, it was like, oh, they're, you know, upper middle class family in New York raising their kids, and they're cultured. And it's like, oh, it's like, and they were, we went to HBCUs. They were proud Black people. There was all these little things that the Cosby Show was doing. And then you fast forward some 12 years, and all of a sudden you had that, you know, you had the senator coming out of Illinois running for president. Like there was something in the mindset that changes when you see what it looks like. And I think that it speaks to, and the thing is understanding the struggle for LGBTQ rights. They're still real. It's still very, very real. But I think that within the Black community, there is such a long history of a permanence of race. And, you know, it was built on slavery. 1619, that 1619 project by the New York Times, all different essays. And it shows the dark history of how, you know, slavery began, brought them over here. And, you know, the stories are so different. And it was like this conscious decision to add slavery into the law of the land. Like that was the intention of it. And so when you see that, and it was so built into the culture, that's why you don't see that, because it's so ingrained in the community, in the culture. It's so ingrained in the culture to be that way. So housing is based on that. You know, that people in the 1950s, when they had the whole the New Deal, when that came out, they purposely excluded Black people from getting housing. And so they weren't able to build generational wealth. So there's this constant ways in there. Whereas things, I think, with the LGBTQ community, there was a lot of norms, and then all of a sudden they started trying to build in some rights, but then they were trying to take away some rights. And so you started having states in America start to do things like, you know, okay, so you know, anti-gay laws, and so anti-sodomy laws, and so you started doing these different things that they were trying to put in the law. But what happened is that they were already starting to create equal justice for Blacks at those times. So you start to then see an unraveling, even trying to do those. So I think the struggle is, you know, that there's been a benefit, but I also think too strongly that, you know, race has been such a strong America culture, especially, but in the Western culture, race is such a huge factor that it's so ingrained that when you move one thing, it uncovers 85 other things. And it's just still sitting there, still sitting there. But yeah, so there's a lot of things. And I definitely hear to your point about representation. Yeah, and there's like, there's a lot of layers underneath of it. True.
So I have from one final question for you. And this is a question that's always asked at all of the podcasts. What does rise up mean to you?
Rise up means resistance. I think that it means that we resist against the systemic racism, misogyny, homophobia that is pervasive in American culture by intentional acts on a daily basis. That's what rise up, I think, means to me.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Wow, I have learned so much from this interview, and I want to thank Helen and Wayne for their candid discussion. I know that the coming episodes in this series will continue to delve into this important conversation in a meaningful, impactful way. My hope is that it opens our eyes in order to help us impact change in our communities. Meet the Musicians podcast is produced by Rise Up Chorus, a community music organization whose focus is on bringing the community together to sing. For more information about Rise Up Chorus, visit us online at www.riseupchorus.org. This is Matthew Lapine saying, thank you so much for listening. We can't wait to have you join us again for our next episode when we meet the musicians.